We call upon the federal, provincial, territorial, and Aboriginal governments to commit to reducing the number of Aboriginal children in care by 1. Monitoring and assessing neglect investigations, 2. Providing adequate resources.
10 years ago, Canada was given a tremendous responsibility. On June 2, 2015, lead commissioner, the Honourable Justice Murray Sinclair, delivered the final report on Truth and Reconciliation. In it, 94 calls to action.
Based on principles of mutual recognition, mutual respect, and shared responsibility for maintaining...
He called upon Canada to redress child welfare, education, language and culture, health,
justice,
and reconciliation.
A royal proclamation of reconciliation.
The 94 calls to action were a blueprint for transforming the relationship between Indigenous peoples and Canada. A roadmap for reconciliation. 10 years later, with only a fraction completed, Canada's reconciliation journey has seemingly stalled. But there are still those who are picking up the line. Danse, Anine, Bouju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. This season on Unreserved, we're focusing on the calls to action on justice, the injustices faced by too many Indigenous people, and those who continue to fight for change. Jolene Ashini earned a law degree. Her goal? To reclaim Indigenous law.
I have the same education as you, but I also have a degree to implement my laws and say that they are equal to yours.
And Senator Kim Pate is advocating to have 12 Indigenous women exonerated. She says part of that work means strengthening community support as a whole.
Canada's a rich country. There's no excuse for people not to be housed, no excuse for people not to have access to education, enough food, clean water.
Today, answering the calls to justice, one heart, one mind, one community at a time. Jolene Ashini grew up around protests and lawsuits in Sheheshi Innu First Nation. During the 1990s, she witnessed her father and other Innu get arrested for protesting against low-level military flights over their territory. Daniel Ashini, who passed in 2009, was the former president of the Innu Nation. The respected leader believed and instilled in his daughters that it was not a crime to defend their land and way of life. It's that influence that led Jolene to become the first Labrador Innu woman to earn a law degree. Not to take part in what she saw as an unjust system, but to change it from the inside. Having witnessed the justice system's failures toward her people, she wants to integrate Indigenous legal traditions into Canadian common law. Jolene, welcome to Unreserved.
Wow, thank you. What an introduction.
So let's start from that auspicious beginning in the 1990s. What was happening in Sheheshi and the greater Innu Nation during that time?
There was a lot happening at that point in time. So at this point in the 1990s, the Innu still had not received recognition under the Indian Acts. And so there was a lot of sort of social issues, justice issues. There was just a plethora of things that come with not being recognized by the federal government. There was minimal funding. There was a community in dire need.
How would you describe the justice system, you know, the police, the court system, etc.?
It was very new. So our community didn't get settled until about 1949, even later. So at that point, the Innu were still very nomadic. So it's within my parents, my grandparents' age that we were still a nomadic people. And so having the justice system and the legal system introduced in the 50s was a huge change for the Innu. So there was, as you know, like probably quite a lot of involvement at that point with the justice system, because all of these new rules and regulations that were not Innu were imposed on us. This is a new system that people had no experience or no knowledge of.
So what kinds of things were, you know, were happening within that justice system with the clashes around not being able to speak the language, not really understanding the rules? And of course, you have this colonial system coming in and saying, you have to do this now. So what kinds of things were happening in the community?
There was a lot of social protesting happening at that point. It was when, say, somebody got arrested for protesting for land rights situations, the entire community would come out to support. And so you would have an entire community of Innu people sitting outside that courtroom and sitting outside because it was packed inside because they wanted to make sure that the people who were trying to support their ways of living were going to be treated fairly. And then you see a justice system that is so colonial imposed on you, and they're using the rules of colonial white settler men that can be perceived as wrong to the Innu. So there was so much protest, there was so much animosity, there was fighting between the Innu and the non-Indigenous communities in Labrador. So it was quite a tough thing to witness.
Yes, that must have been very confusing to witness. And of course, among those, you know, Innu that were protesting and defending land and territory and right was your father, Daniel Ashini. How did you see him growing up? How did he get involved in the fight?
He got involved at quite a young age, and some older Innu leaders had kind of taken him under his wing. So one, for example, is Greg Pinashwe, who was one of the front runners and at the forefront of trying to get more funding and programming and services for the Innu. And so he had learned from that. And fortunately, he spent so much time in Neuchâtel and on the land. He knew the importance of our land and the way that we live, the way that we conduct ourselves, the way that we govern ourselves. So he knew that he had two passions. One was cultural preservation, and the other one was justice for the Innu. So he had this very huge outlook on life and what he would like to see the Innu become at that point. And he just spent his entire time fighting for the Innu from the moment he got into politics to the moment that he took his last breath. He had this passion about preserving our identity and fighting for our identity to be seen until the day that he died.
And how did that strength and that passion and that resolute drive to defend Innu ultimately drive you?
I think it was more or less the point of him coming home at the end of the day completely defeated. And we also, my sister and I, had a father who wasn't there because he was off in the world fighting for us to have a better life. And so to see our dad when we did see him, to come back exhausted from, say, going to Ottawa and trying to negotiate with the federal government, or coming back from across the world to see how other Indigenous people across the world live, to try to understand how their systems have implemented and affected their cultures. It was a thing that I think that his frustration was a thing that made me want to continue that fight. I was quite comfortable wanting to do what he wanted to do, to try to save the community, to do better, to try to keep not just our culture alive, but our identity, our rights, to fight, to see the injustice, seeing him get arrested and incarcerated so many times just to try to fight for us, I think for me was a thing that empowered me to question, how can this be right? How can I be living in a world where to stand up for yourself is wrong?
So you had these two, you know, you grew up in a harsh sort of education, right? You had what you were seeing happening to your people, the Innu people, that they had no voice, they had no recognition. And that was a long, hard battle. Then your strong, passionate father who led. What was the moment that you took those two things and said, okay, I need to become a lawyer? What was your moment?
I really don't think I had that moment, but I knew that my entire life I was on a path, and I will always refer to my life and my career as a path, because when my father passed away, I went to university with the idea I was going to get a major in psychology and a minor in political science, and that would put me on the route to law school. a colleague of mine now, but I like to refer to her as my chosen auntie. She works at Ulfius Clear and Townshend, the firm that I currently work with. And her name is Maggie Wente. She sent me over a pamphlet for the University of Victoria's joint degree program in Indigenous and Common Law. And I had basically said to her that I didn't want to take a law school program that only gave me a distinction in Aboriginal law, that I wanted to actually practice Indigenous laws, because the Indigenous people have been governing themselves and creating their own laws for thousands of years that is not recognized. And so I said, oh, yeah, I'll read this pamphlet. And then I think I probably spent about 20 minutes reading the pamphlet. And then I texted her back and was like, take my money, University of Victoria, because I'm signing up.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest today is Jolene Ashini, the first Innu lawyer. You threw your money, as you say, at the University of Victoria, attended and graduated from their joint Canadian Common Law and Indigenous Legal Orders program. What is special about this program?
It's special because it was a program that was actually created as a response to the TRC, so the Truth and Reconciliation's calls to action on education and legal education. So this program was designed by Val Napoleon and John Burroughs. And so they wanted to create a legal education that actually took into account Indigenous legal orders, Indigenous laws, and then the way that Indigenous people operate. So you graduate from this four-year program with not only a degree in Canadian common law, but also a degree in Indigenous legal orders. So the idea is to be able to, once you get in within this Canadian system, to try to implement some of those Indigenous ways of thinking and Indigenous ways of law.
And what made it perfect for you?
It made it perfect for me because I wanted to get it's so unfortunate to say this, but I wanted to get a colonial education and have that recognition so that when I sit across the table from the officials that have for many years put every Indigenous person sitting across from them down, that I could basically whip out my degree and say, I have the same education as you, but I also have a degree to implement my laws and say that they are equal to yours. So it gives me the tools to be able to help Indigenous communities and First Nations create laws that actually run ideally in the same realm as colonial law.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you walked into that classroom that first day, what did that feel like? What were you thinking about as you walked into that classroom?
I thought so many things, but the biggest thing that I thought about is how proud my dad would be, and that how he, if he were still alive at that point in his life, probably would have went to that program himself. I get quite emotional talking about it, but he wasn't there to see the achievement that I had. But I walked into that classroom looking across from, at that point, there was 26 of us in that cohort, and looking across the room at these 25 other students, I thought, we're going to hopefully one day help change Canadian law.
Do you imagine what he might have said to you?
He was not a man of many words to his children. he was a quiet man, so he probably would have said something along the lines of, good job.
Mm-hmm. And that's high praise. I get that from my mama sometimes. Good, my girl. That's good.
and that's exactly it. Oh, that's good. And it would just be that sentence, and you would be able to feel that he's proud of you, but it was also a part of him to keep his praise limited to for when it was needed.
Yeah. How are you incorporating, you know, doing that, incorporating Indigenous legal traditions within Canadian common law in your work?
One of the files that I have that is ongoing is helping my First Nation and my sister First Nation of Natwashish create their very own child welfare law and agency. And I don't know if that hits home more than anything else, but taking my lived experience of being an Innu woman and my experience on the land, which we call Nuchimit, and applying those rules and applying those principles and those values into the way that we want our children to come back home, into the way that we want our families to operate as a unit, into the way that we want our social workers to follow a policy, I think is something that is so important to me that I cannot believe that I get the opportunity and the privilege to work with my community. So that is a first step. And I hope as time goes on, and hopefully before my retirement, we have similar laws to these. And hopefully when my community goes to being a self-governing nation, that I will be there to help that process along, to help write all of the things that need to be written and to have validity in our Innu laws. If you have the lived experience, it makes your job as a lawyer even more rich because you can help the people in a way that they understand, in a way that they want help in, because it's harder to be, I think, an ally that is non-Indigenous than it is to be an Indigenous person to say, I come from a res just like you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. As you said, you know, the common law, Canadian common law is, you know, geared from a different perspective than Indigenous law would be. Indigenous law is often centered around community and balance and these particular kind of teachings that you have to take into your life to live Minobiamatisuin, which is the good life. Can you imagine how you might change or integrate Canadian common law with the seemingly disparate Indigenous viewpoint?
Common law is quite black and white. You kind of want a yes or no answer, but Indigenous laws are gray, because there are so many different conditions that should be met depending on the person, the community, the people. And so I think that grayness is what is scary. We have a familial obligation. We have an obligation to our aunties, to our grandparents, to our uncles, to our parents. And so we need to think about this, I think, in an introspective way and move out in how we can actually operate within a bigger system than our community. And I'm really hoping that the more people that graduate from the University of Victoria or with an Aboriginal law distinction, or if other universities move into an Indigenous legal order, legal program, hopefully there will be enough of us then to put our minds together to think about a way in which we can contribute our education and help change the view on what law should look like in the future.
Mm. So then, are you envisioning or hoping, or sort of, what is it you are envisioning for the future?
So in an ideal world would be that we can operate in, I guess, what you would call like our own mini jurisdictions. So the way that Saskatchewan is different from Newfoundland and Labrador, the way that Ontario is different from the Yukon, but to have these in Indigenous nations, so the Innu of Labrador are comparable to the Innu in Quebec. We could have these jurisdictions that tie in these groups of Indigenous people, but we can also operate, I guess, in a term that would be recognizable, like an interprovincial but interjurisdictional operation. And in reality, it doesn't seem that hard.
Yeah. What would you say to those that might say, as I imagine they might, that would be unworkable to have so many different, you know, jurisdictions, cultural or First Nation, Innu, all that, or that that wouldn't be fair, that you would have different laws and being treated differently and all of these things that I can imagine someone might say about that?
I think I would return that with a question of how are so many levels of, I guess, law and court in Canada fair right now? Why is it that we as a people, and I'm not just referring to the Innu, but all of the Indigenous people across Canada, why is it fair that we have to have a legal tradition imposed on us that was never our tradition. Prior to your arrival in this country, we have been governing ourselves and constituting ourselves and having repercussions to actions for thousands of years without problems. Without problems that we see right now. It's within arm's reach in a way, but it's also so far. I wrestle with this question a lot because I know that it can be done. But how do we get to that point of getting it done is complicated because I think that people like Val Napoleon and John Burroughs have been around for so many years advocating for Indigenous ways of being and legal identity. And it wasn't until my program started in 2018 that this recognition happened, that the TRC came, they wanted to take action, they did this. We've been around for thousands of years, and yet it was 2018 until something was done. There's recognition. I think we are on the cusp of identifying, and we're on the cusp of potentially moving forward. But the recognition of Indigenous laws and legal orders has been very minimal.
And finally, Jolene, as you continue on your own journey, taking lessons from your nation, from your father, from those who came before you, what messages would you want to leave other youth who might be listening and want to perhaps, also challenge the system that you are challenging today?
What a good question. I think that I will always say, and especially to those youth in my community, that I don't want to be the one who sets the bar. I don't want to be the person that attained one thing. Yes, I am the first Labrador Inuit person to become a licensed legal practitioner in Canada, but I want you to do better than me. I want you to set the bar higher than I could. I did it to prove that we can do it. I did it to prove that a child who came from a background full of substance abuse and intergenerational trauma, that I can succeed despite the world telling me that I could not succeed. And so I know that there are people out there who think and dream about these type of careers, but they feel like the world is just giving them too much of a push, that they came from a background where they have no money, where their intergenerational trauma is quite high, where they feel like attaining this is impossible, because I too once thought attaining this was impossible. But it is. It's possible. I think that having the passion and the want is the most important thing, and everything else will fall in place, and you will be able to also walk a path that gets you to where you need to be when you need to be there.
Jolene, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the time.
Jolene Ashini is a member of the Sheheshi Innu First Nation in Labrador. She is the first Innu lawyer. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild.
We call upon federal, provincial, and territorial governments to commit to eliminating the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in custody over the next decade.
It's been a decade since the TRC called to eliminate the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in custody. But the numbers have actually grown, and Indigenous women are disproportionately impacted. In a few minutes, Senator Kim Pate tells us why she is using her decades of experience with the justice system to clear the names of 12 Indigenous women.
All of these women were constructed as dangerous and violent in large part because even though the system didn't act to protect them, as soon as they acted to protect themselves or others in their care, the full weight of the law came down upon them.
Senator Pate on how she is answering the call to justice. First, some music to inspire. Alberta indie folk group Rubin in the Dark teamed up with the Bullhorn Singers, a drumming and singing group from the Kainai Blood Tribe. Together, they created a collaborative music project called Rubin and the Bullhorn Singers. They call it the conversation that happens after truth and reconciliation. Here's Rubin and the Bullhorn Singers with All These Roads. That's Rubin and the Bullhorn Singers with All These Roads. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, answering the calls to action, one heart, one mind, and one case at a time. For Senator Kim Pate, the case to bring justice to 12 Indigenous women is one she started building more than four decades ago. In her work, which includes 24 years as the executive director for the Elizabeth Fry Societies, she watched the system fail women again and again. A few years ago, Kim presented 12 different cases for one single review. It showed that while these women were convicted of different crimes, the factors that led to the miscarriage of justice were the same. Many of these 12 women remain nameless and voiceless, but Kim hopes that someday soon, everyone will know their names and their stories. Kim, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you very much, Rosanna.
Now, you made the case for the review and exoneration of these 12 Indigenous women. How did you become involved in this fight?
One of the very big reasons that this is an issue for me is for the past, the better part of 5 decades now, I've been working in and around the systems with people who have been victimized and criminalized, young people, men and women. And disproportionately, as you mentioned, we're seeing the numbers increasing. And one of the things that became very clear when I started working with women after working with men is they often took responsibility for things far beyond what is legal responsibility. And many were criminalized for things that we wouldn't necessarily see men criminalized for. And when we talk about Indigenous women, the situation was all the more intense. We see the impact of residential schools. We see the impact of trauma and abuse. And it's not an accident that the very same issues that the MMIWG, the Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, found that the same issues that give rise to Indigenous women being more likely to be disappeared, murdered on the streets, homeless, are also the same issues that result in them being criminalized. And in short, our jails are full of the people who are failed by every other system, and who has been failed more than Indigenous people, but most particularly Indigenous women. So as we're having this discussion, Indigenous women are 1 in 2 of the federal prison population. 2 days ago, I was visiting one of the women in this report in one of the prisons, and we were going over yet another series of examples of how the intersection of racism, class bias, as well as gender bias, have really intersected to construct her as someone other than the person that I have known for more than 30 years.
Mm. Was there a moment when you knew that this was something that you wanted to stand up and take on?
Well, actually, the report and the work that we did on these 12 women was really instigated by the work of Justices Harry Laforme and Juanita Westmoreland Traore when they were asked by the then Minister of Justice, Lametti, to look at the whole conviction review process. And part of the reason he asked one of the first senior justices who's Indigenous and one of the first senior justices who's Black in this country to look at these issues is at that stage when he asked them, there had only been one Indigenous man, one Black man, and 18 white men whose cases had been reviewed through the current justice process, the process that existed. So I've known both of those justices for a long time, and they asked me if I could pull together some Indigenous women because they wanted to get a sense of what the situation was and why in particular Indigenous women's cases weren't being reviewed. So the reason it's these 12 is these are women I've known for some of them over 40 years, 20, 30, 40 years. They're women I know very well. I know what happened to them. I've followed them through the system. And there are many, many more than these 12, but these are 12 where I felt if the review process looked at their cases together, they would see the themes that we know all too well, the themes of dislocation from community, from family, that the child welfare, so-called child welfare system, brings about, the residential school system, resulted in the past histories of abuse. All of these women were either themselves in residential school or a first or second generation. All of them have histories of abuse. All of them at some point were involved in the child welfare system. All of them then were in situations where they were trying to navigate poverty and violence. And their criminalization in all of their cases was a result of them reacting and trying to survive those situations. In many of the cases, I think they should have had the benefit of self-defense and should never have even been convicted. In some of the cases, they may have been convicted of lesser offenses, but all of these women were constructed as dangerous and violent in large part because even though the system didn't act to protect them, as soon as they acted to protect themselves or others in their care, the full weight of the law came down upon them. And in two of the cases now are quite public, Odelia and Narissa Cusance are two of the women, because since then, the then Minister of Justice, Lametti, agreed to look at their cases, what happened in their situation. And like the four men, the Woodhouses and Mr. Anderson, we see the same sorts of issues in their case, and it's being aired publicly now in terms of, you know, tunnel vision of police, I would say abuse of process by police, Crown prosecutors narrowing in and zeroing in, not following court orders, but also going after certain individuals because they believe they fit the stereotype of who they're looking for, and then convicting them and not paying any attention to their explanations or their attempts to contextualize what happened. Now, unlike the men in this, the four men that I just mentioned, in the cases of many of these women, they don't themselves even seek a review. It often has taken years to convince these women that what happened to them was unfair. They may have felt it was unfair, but they felt that what happened to them was legal. And in many cases, it's taken years for them to appreciate that their sense of responsibility, whether it's familial responsibility, as in the case of Adelia and Narissa, they felt responsible for a younger cousin, and they were with him the night that he killed the man that they were also convicted of killing. And so they felt responsible because in their community and their family, as part of the way they were raised, they were, you know, if somebody else was did something who was in their care or with them, who was younger than them and part of their family, part of their community, they had a responsibility. And so that responsibility, though, does not equate with legal responsibility. And I don't know that they're lawyers. I don't know that, and certainly not the police or the prosecutor, and or the, it doesn't appear that the judge in this case ever took the time to fully contextualize what had happened for those women. And the same is true for these other women as well.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest today is Senator Kim Pate. For the past 3 years, she's been advocating for 12 Indigenous women to have their criminal cases reviewed. She says they all share a history of dislocation by child welfare, abuse, and poverty. Kim says these Indigenous women were constructed as dangerous and violent by a justice system that did not protect them. So you've described, you know, who these women are and what these cases have in common sort of collectively. But in terms of the question, why they were not, in, you know, being reviewed and exonerated, what did you find in that regard?
Well, quite frankly, the biases continue. The biases that exist, the racial and sexist biases that exist in terms of the police response or lack of response when they're being victimized themselves to the what we often refer to as hyper-responsabilizing and deputizing of women. And what I mean by that is that, as Trish Montour, the late Trish Montour, used to say, if a white woman is told she's responsible for what she, how she dresses, what she wears, where she's going, an Indigenous woman is hyper-responsabilized, that she is to blame if she is victimized because somehow she has failed to protect herself or those in her care. And so that hyper-responsabilization and that deputization to protect yourself is huge. And yet, the instant that they take an action to defend themselves, whether it's by picking up a plate or a knife or a frying pan or whatever to ward off blows or to try and escape, they're more likely to be criminalized and imprisoned than often men would be in those same situations. And I'm not saying that there isn't racism when it comes to men. We know that that's, I mean, men are one in three federal prisoners. So women are one in two, men are one in three. So the issue is compounded by the intersections of discrimination, if I can put it that way, that, you know, we see the discrimination mount upon itself. And then once they're in the system, they're more likely to be classified as dangerous and violent. And we know from a number of cases that have gone through the courts that the classification system within prisons is also discriminatory. And so they're more likely to be classified as higher risk. That means paradoxically, that they get less access to programs and services, makes it harder for them to actually jump through the correctional hoops to move through the system and cascade to a lower security and ultimately to the community. So they're also more likely to be kept in higher security, segregation, and ultimately often released to the street without support. So it's a very vicious cycle, and it's one that we need to stop.
Yeah, certainly puts a lot of Indigenous women between a rock and a hard place. You mentioned a couple of cases earlier, Odelia and Larissa. Could you tell us a little bit more about those cases?
Sure. So Odelia and Larissa are sisters. They, along with their cousin, were co-accused of killing a man in Saskatchewan more than 30 years ago. And their cousin confessed that it was him who had killed the man, in part because he had made sexual advances on the girls. And they were trying to fight him off, and he intervened. They went home and told their grandmother that they had been responsible for the death of a man. And that ended up being used against them because, as I mentioned, they talked about they felt responsible for what their cousin had done. Even though the police knew they had a statement as to who had actually done the killing, and there was some suggestion that there was some coercion, attempts to coerce them into confessing, they took responsibility for what they understood they were responsible for, according to their community, their family, but they never said that they actually killed the man, and yet they ended up serving life sentences for murder. It was second-degree murder, and so they should have been eligible for parole at 10 years, but they served well past that and basically are now having their cases reviewed. But it's been several years since the cases were referred, and so they're trying to live their lives, and as they wait on literally on pins and needles for a decision to come down about what happens in whether their conviction will be overturned. It's possible they'll be sent back for a new trial. I think the evidence is pretty clear that they should, in my humble opinion, they should be acquitted. But it remains to be seen what will happen.
Senator Kim Pates is my guest today. She's been supporting the review and exoneration of 12 Indigenous women. Two of those women, Odelia and Larissa Cusons, are still waiting for a decision from Canada's Minister of Justice. They've been out on bail since 2023, when the review of their case began. This timeline isn't uncommon. Decisions like this can take years. The Cuson sisters testified they were both involved in a fight with Anthony Joseph Dolph in February of 1993. Now in their 50s, they were aged 18 and 20 back then. Their cousin, then a minor, admitted to stabbing Dolph after he made unwanted advances on the girls. He served 4 years for second-degree murder. Odelia testified she and Larissa were not in the room during the murder, yet they served nearly 30 years for second-degree murder. So then what do you think needs to change, you know, so that our justice system is actually just?
Yeah. Well, I want it to be just. I call it a legal system because there isn't much just about it at this point. And one of the things I've tried to do is put together about a few years, 4 years ago, I was doing a session for an organization around these issues. And I did a chart that showed every intervention we have made to try and reform the system. There's Gladue courts, there's Gladue reports, there's healing lodges, all of these things, but they've all been add-ons to the system. And so as we've added on to the system, we've actually made ourselves, and I count myself because I'm, especially now that I'm part of the government, but even before then, I'm part of the system. The more we add on, the more we make ourselves feel okay about putting Indigenous people there. And so, you know, one of the things and one of the main reasons that I went to the Senate is one of the clear things is unless we build up community and provide better supports, economic, social and health supports in community, we're not likely to see this change, because what we do now is we add on to the system and we take people temporarily out of community, put them in the system, and then if they don't die in the system, we plunk them back into the community with no better off, and in fact now with a criminal record and now separated for sometimes decades from their families and communities of support. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do is work on how do we actually build up community? How do we make sure every single... Canada's a rich country. There's no excuse for us not to have adequate supports in the community. No excuse for people not to be housed. No excuse for people not to have access to education, enough food, clean water. And those are all part of what I think we need to do. And more importantly, it's you know, if we look to countries like Scandinavian countries where they have invested in these kinds of approaches. They have far fewer people in prison. They have far lower crime rates. They have far lower victimization rates because we know not all crimes are reported. And people are happier. Why wouldn't we want that? Why wouldn't we want that for every Indigenous person, every person in this country? And yet we continue to repeat the same mistakes and keep adding on to the system.
Mm. In the bigger picture, as we know, it has been, you know, a decade, 10 years since the 94 calls to action were presented to Canada. Yet very few calls to action have been started in the area of justice, as we said earlier. You know, it seems to be getting worse, not better. Why do you think that is? Is it a lack of will? Is it a lack of time, resource? What does that play here?
Well, I think what's really at play is people refusing to acknowledge that it's the inequities, the systemic inequities that we are not solving that are contributing to this. So if we tinker with the criminal legal system, if we add in a few healing lodges, if we add in some special reports, somehow we make ourselves feel better that we're actually addressing the issue. We see very much an unwillingness or a lack of accountability on the part of the system for these systemic and individual inequities. And so really trying to remedy those as part of it. And right now we're unfortunately trying to do it case by case. Part of the reason we put forward the suggestion of reviewing the 12 women's cases together is when you see all of their cases and the range of regions they're from, and I mean many from the prairies, but if you look at the range of their experiences, you see the commonalities in terms of the systemic injustices.
Mm-hmm. You know, but where to start? I mean, if you could change one thing about the system tomorrow, what would it be?
Well, I would say that we start with reviewing these 12 women's cases and immediately remedy those situations. And I think that in itself would cause a ripple effect within the prison system. Credit to those who have been in the system. A number of folks are now coming to me and saying, you know, will you work on this case? Will you work on this woman's case? Because what they've seen is individuals come out, and despite the fact that they may have been part of the system that defined them as dangerous and violent, they're seeing them in the community and seeing them in a very different light. And I think those are the examples that will help change. But for obvious reasons, I mean, even these women did not want to be public. Their experiences of injustice were so profound that, you know, Adelia and Narissa did agree once the government agreed to review their cases. But most of the women don't want to go public because they're fearful of the kind of a negative attitudes that led them to be where they are will continue. And not surprisingly, many of them don't want to come forward.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So what's next now for the 12 women that you want to see exonerated?
Well, there are two who are still inside of those 12. One has died, sadly, and one who I just saw yesterday is dying. And so my hope is that we see a commitment to a review sooner rather than later, and that we learn from that and in a very real way. Because once there's an indication that they might be exonerated, I am pretty confident that many of them would be willing to speak out. But right now, some of them are grandmothers, a number of them are mothers, and they all have families or and communities of support, but they don't want what happened to them and what happened to their families when they were first convicted to then be visited on grandchildren and others. So, you know, it's a terrible catch-22, because some folks will say to me, well, if because you won't tell the stories more broadly, give more information about who they are, we can't get a public campaign. And yet the women say, if there's no guarantee we're going to get anything, why should we put our names forward? And I've been involved with them for a long time, and their paranoia is not unfounded. Sometimes when they've spoken out to try and defend or advocate for one of their sister friends, someone else who's been in prison or is on parole with them, they've then been penalized or they've then been dragged back into prison for alleged breaches of their conditions. So it's a terrible catch-22 that they're in. And it's why I think it's important for all of us as we have this information, and why I'm so grateful that you're talking about this, because it's on all of us to try and remedy this situation. We shouldn't be asking those who are most negatively impacted to be the ones trying to defend their right to have a fair process.
Kim, where do you get hope to keep going with this fight?
Oh, well, every time I see and talk to these women, and so many others, and the fact that they have survived lives and life events that I can't even imagine, that's where I get hope. I mean, it's the very least I can do with all the privileges and opportunities I now have. And to see them with their families, with their children, with their grandchildren, and the joy, despite horrific life experiences that they have endured and abuse, the fact that they find joy, even though they're not fully free yet, they make the most of it. And that is such an inspiration, and, you know, keeps me pushing to do everything that I can to, you know, move this further along.
Thank you for your time today, Senator.
Oh, thank you.
Senator Kim Pate was appointed to the Senate of Canada on November 10th, 2016. She is fighting for the review and exoneration of 12 Indigenous women. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, Amanda Gear, Zoe Tennant, and Rhiannon Johnson. You can now listen to Unreserved streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. You can also find and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Daychub, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Gidanaskanamitnawa. Ayusay.